Grid Lords by Tom Rath.
More episodes are already waiting at patreon.com/TomRath.
The voice you are hearing is generated by AI. Episode 2, Chapter 6. The Emperor walked slowly, methodically through the courtyard of the tower, observing the lines of soldiers as they practiced their drills. They wielded various weapons, including swords, muskets, and rifles, in perfect unison. Each movement was precise, designed to prepare them for the different levels of command and the complexities that came with using each weapon. A hood covered the Emperor's head as a brisk, cold wind blew in from the lake. The air carried a scent of the ocean with it, reminding the Emperor of the sea beyond the harbor of the Boston. He silently judged the soldiers, taking note of their failures more than their successes. There was always room for improvement, and it was his job to ensure that his troops were the best they could be. In another corner of the courtyard, a group of young men practiced under the watchful eye of a priest, dressed in flowing white robes. These men were training for the choosing, a ceremony where the Empire selected a new sword, a champion to serve as a symbol of strength and unity. It had been far too long since the Empire had a good sword, and the Emperor was growing impatient. The group moved with a fluidity that was almost unnatural, as if they were extensions of the priest himself. Their poses and actions seemed strange to the untrained eye, more akin to a dance than a martial exercise. It was this unique style of combat that made the selection of a new sword so vital to the continued prosperity of the Empire. As he watched the training unfold before him, the Emperor couldn't help but feel a sense of anticipation. Soon, a new sword would rise, and with them, the Empire would find a renewed sense of purpose and hope. The Emperor continued walking, the cold Boston air brushing against his cheeks as he made his way back to the tower's entrance. He had much to consider before the choosing, and little time to do so. The Emperor knew that in order to maintain the strength and prestige of his empire, he needed to find a new sword from within his own state, a proud Bostonian. The barbarians were at the gates, and for too long, the Empire had struggled to defend its borders and acquire the orbs it needed to thrive. In the past, especially during the reign of the Blood Prince, the Empire had been unstoppable, its vast army amassing orbs and grid crowns at a staggering rate. Under the Blood Prince's rule, the Bostonian Empire had expanded far and wide. The surrounding states had either succumbed to its military might or bowed to its intimidating presence. Through war and diplomacy, the Empire had spread its influence, trading flows and ebbs, the lifeblood of their civilization, to desperate neighbors. At its zenith, the Empire had stretched all the way to Carolina in the south and Chicago in the west, amassing dozens of grid lords from conquered cities to serve the Emperor's every whim. Yet since the mysterious disappearance of the Blood Knight, the Empire had begun to fray at the edges. Its once formidable grip on the surrounding territories had weakened, and threats began to seep in from all sides. The time had come to select a new sword, a beacon of hope who would rally the people and defend their way of life. As the Emperor stood at the entrance of the tower, deep in thought, he knew that he couldn't afford to make a mistake in his choice. The fate of the Empire rested on his shoulders, and its very survival hinged on the strength and resolve of the sword he would select. The Emperor sighed, speaking softly to himself. "Ah, Tiberius, I didn't know what I had when you were here. Things are floundering now." As he rubbed his brow, the weight of his concerns pressed heavily on his mind. The once expansive empire was contracting, the once loyal cities were growing bolder, more brazen, and the precious orbs they could gather were needed more than ever at home. The vast stores of orbs that had been amassed over the years were dwindling at an alarming rate, consumed by the luxury and wealth to which everyone had grown so accustomed. "They all grew soft," he muttered to himself, feeling the truth of his words as a bitter realization. "Nearly 2 centuries of prosperity, of victory. Boston has a first sector as large as some entire cities. But we all grew too comfortable, and now we're paying the price for our complacency." The Emperor knew that even the tributary states had grown soft in their dependency on his empire's generosity, making it all the more challenging for him to find new gridlords worthy of the prestigious title. It was as if they'd forgotten the hard work and grit that had built the empire in the first place and given way to a sense of entitlement and indolence. The emperor found his thoughts wandering to an old proverb that he had heard long ago. Wooden shoes go up the stairs, silken slippers go down. He reflected on the profound wisdom of this phrase, recognizing that those who rise to greatness do so through struggle and perseverance, whereas those who rest on their laurels inevitably decline. As he stood there, taking in the sight of the soldiers training before him, the emperor felt a renewed determination to find a sword who would embody the resilience and tenacity that had once been the hallmark of the Bostonian Empire. It would not be an easy task, but it was one that he could not afford to fail. As the emperor turned his head, he noticed the stout form of Baron Ironveil approaching him. He sighed inwardly, knowing that he could no longer just dismiss the nobles like he used to. These days, he needed their support, particularly with the growing unrest throughout the empire. Upon reaching the emperor, Ironveil offered a polite greeting. "Emperor, I find you well, I hope?" The emperor responded with subtle disdain. "Silas, how can I be well, with these fops as our best hope? One of these is to be our sword. We need to do better. We need someone who can compete with Brightforge and the Red King. These fools are soft, probably spoiled with too much ice cream growing up." Ironveil replied, "I keep saying we need to look beyond our borders. The Rust Knight's alliance with the Hill Clans is an example. He would have made a fine addition, and there are others who are changing sides in these times of change." The emperor scowled, noticing a lack of respect in Ironveil's voice that wouldn't have been tolerated in the past. He argued, "I've told you before, Silas, Boston is the heart of our empire. The sword must come from here to demonstrate our strength and birthright." In the emperor's eyes, Ironveil was a mere pup, a mortal like the others, a child barely in his 50s. How could he understand the true meaning of the sword and the history behind it? Yet, even as the emperor dismissed Ironveil's suggestion, a seed of doubt had been planted in his mind. Was it worth considering the possibility of looking beyond their own borders to find the perfect sword, the champion who could restore the empire to its former glory? Only time would tell if his steadfast belief in a homegrown hero would prove wise or foolish. Ironveil continued to press his point. "We could send out feelers, dispatch agents to find dissatisfied gridlords who may be willing to join us. If not a sword, perhaps another. The shield in Cleveland has changed sides before, and the axe in Pittsburgh is ambitious and wasted on their feeble forces." The emperor raised an eyebrow. The idea of Thorn Jackswolf or Merdin Galehart becoming a gridlord in Boston intriguing him for a moment. However, he quickly dismissed the notion. "We don't have the resources to woo them, and it's a risky idea at best. They don't possess the loyalty we need. Our empire is being challenged both inside and out, and the last thing we need is heroes without loyalty. We need to show that we can still produce the greatest warriors, like Tiberius Bloodsword, that ungrateful bastard. We gave him everything. We made him a legend of legends." Ironveil muttered under his breath, "And he gave us everything in return." The emperor's sharp gaze sent Ironveil staggering back a few steps, the tension palpable between them. Despite the baron's willingness to explore other options, the emperor remained resolute in his belief that the empire's salvation must come from within. The people needed to witness the rise of a new hero, born and bred in the heart of the empire, to restore their faith and loyalty. To the emperor, the very existence of the Bostonian Empire hinged on finding the perfect sword, a champion who would not only defend its borders, but also inspire its citizens. The search would be arduous, and compromise seemed increasingly appealing. Yet as time grew short and the pressure mounted, the emperor held steadfast to his conviction that the answer to their problems lay right in front of them, and he was determined to find it. Ironveil spoke up again. "The reason I came to speak with you is the situation in New York. I understand that the North King and South King have been meeting, and I suspect they may be considering a truce." The emperor was taken aback, an uncharacteristic chill running down his spine. New York was home to 10 suits, 5 loyal to each king, and their gridlords were vital to maintaining a significant portion of his remaining vassals. If New York were to unite against him, they could potentially break free from the Empire's control, an outcome that was previously unthinkable. Anger flashed in the Emperor's eyes as he snapped, "What are you doing about it, Silas? This is your field of expertise. Why are you only telling me now?" Iron Veil responded calmly, "I have pieces in place, but I have a drastic idea that I need to clear with you first, lest I incur your wrath." Both concerned and curious, the Emperor asked, "What is it?" Iron Veil explained, "The people of New York, both north and south, are growing more and more restless due to scarce resources and too many years of poor performance on the field. They have been relying on the orbs we provide. Our agents there have been sowing unrest, planting the idea in their minds that they could reject their kings in favor of direct rule." The Emperor considered this bold plan and asked, "Wouldn't the people of New York be upset about Boston's own lack of success finding orbs?" Iron Veil responded, "Orbs heal all. They get the factories running, the lights back on, and the people's lives comfortable again." Deep in contemplation, the Emperor recognized that such a move would deplete the treasury of the Empire's precious remaining orbs, leaving everything hanging in the balance for the upcoming campaign season. The stakes were high, and the price to pay could be immense. Yet, as he weighed his options, the Emperor couldn't help but feel that this risky gambit might just be the key to maintaining the Empire's tenuous hold on power. Chapter 7. Nicholas took his seat at the long wooden feast table, a sense of wonder washing over him as he marveled at the incredible spread that lay before him. Row upon row of delicious, battered meats glistened with flavorful juices, and the scent wafted through the air, tempting him. The crispy potatoes were spiced to perfection, their golden skin producing an almost glass-like crunch when they were broken in half. To wash it all down, beers and spirits of every type imaginable lay in gleaming tankards and polished goblets, just waiting to be consumed. As Nicholas sat eagerly filling his plate, he reminded himself to savor every moment of this luxurious feast. He would try not to get drunk tonight, despite the tempting abundance of drinks surrounding him. After all, his fellow soldiers deserved a responsible leader who could still maintain some degree of control amid the revelry. The massive hall was full of celebration, with nobles and soldiers alike singing and toasting to their marvelous victory. They had captured the wild orb, a remarkable boon that would benefit their lands and people greatly. The nobles in their nation had not long since thrown off the oppressive yoke of the Empire, and with this latest addition to their treasury, their future was brighter than ever. Nicholas's attention was drawn from his plate as he noticed Joran Brightforge approaching the feast table. The Gridlord still wore his glowing power armor, though his helmet had been removed to enjoy the festivities with the others. It was a rare sight to see Gridlords remove any part of their suits, even to sleep. Order fields generally didn't seem to affect organic matter, except in the most extreme cases. Intense wells of entropy were said to be the source of fiends, but such places were death to men in any case. Some effect of the order field in a Gridlord's suit inhibited aging, keeping their bodies young and in their prime for decades at a time, or even centuries, in the case of the legendary Blood Knight of Boston. Brightforge flashed a handsome smile as he asked, "May I sit with you, Nicholas?" Nicholas, startled, replied with enthusiastic yet fuddled words, "Yes, of course. Please join me." As the Gridlord sat down, the gentle warmth of his suit pulsing nearby, he signaled to a server to bring him some ale. Nicholas drank slowly from his own tankard, trying to think of something meaningful to say. Before he could speak, however, Brightforge started the conversation. "I wanted to thank you for your vital maneuvers in the battle," he said, his tone warm and appreciative. "You and your men were gutsy and brazen. It was dangerous to be so close to the enemy, but you utilized the orb field well and managed to get your guns into action. Your bold choices changed the whole course of the fight, especially when Wraithashade was forced to reevaluate once you opened fire." Nicholas, humbled, looked down at his drink. "I was only doing my job, sir. It was the only course of action I could see." Brightforge nodded, sincerity shining in his eyes. "Others would have chosen courses that keep themselves further from danger. You and your men put yourselves in harm's way, and in doing so, you won us the orb. I have you to thank, and the people of the city have you to thank as well. I'll be sure to mention your efforts in my speech later. You truly deserve the credit for our victory today. Nicholas felt flustered, unsure of what to say. He had always been uncomfortable with fame or praise, but he knew that his men needed recognition for their achievements. He spoke up, his voice filled with a mix of pride and humility. "Mention the 3rd Division, my lord, not me. It was all of us who did our small part, small when compared to the presence of the 3 grid lords. We were barely a finger on the scales." But Brightforge disagreed and replied, "The men followed you, Nicholas. Your strategy, your leadership, and their loyalty to you made all the difference. You were as valuable to the battle as Theedric, Jareth, and myself." Nicholas continued to deflect the praise, making self-deprecating remarks in an attempt to divert the attention from himself. But Brightforge laughed heartily, slinging his arm around Nicholas's shoulders. He raised his glass high and announced, "I hope to have you and the 3rd Division close by during the coming campaign season." Nicholas felt a swell of dread. Constant danger would accompany their constant glory. He quickly voiced his concerns. "We're not equipped for that level of combat, my lord. We're a general-purpose division, and many of our men are green recruits. For some of my sergeants, this was their first battle." However, Brightforge continued to disagree and offered assurances. "The 3rd Division is an impressive unit, and you're an impressive leader. I'm thinking of converting your division, equipping and training them to fight specifically for orbs as specialists. We'd get you new men, new gear, special gear." "Special gear?" Nicholas inquired, intrigued by Brightforge's words. Brightforge nodded, explaining his vision. "Squads with power weapons. The Empire is struggling to purchase the same volume that they have in the past, and so the market is more agreeable. Prices are down, and we've just gained another orb. We have the resources to make such a move during this time of change. With the Empire waning, it's a game of he who dares." Nicholas looked awed and said, "An entire squad with power weapons? I thought the expense would be impossible and such weapons so rare." Brightforge's voice grew more passionate as he said, "I'm thinking we break the bank and equip 1 or even 2 divisions with power weapons and energy weapons. It would be almost like adding a new suit to our arsenal. The impact of having so many more men wielding weapons like that could be akin to adding a grid lord or 2 to the field. Just imagine how the battle would have played out with that kind of gear." Nicholas hesitated, still remembering the terror he felt when he watched a grid lord tear through his men on a distant day gone by. He thought aloud, "We could take on gridlords with enough of these weapons." Brightforge's eyes turned pensive as he watched Nicholas. "But we'll need to put such tools in the right hands. It is an immense power to have so many men armed with weapons like that. That requires absolute loyalty to the city and loyalty to me." Understanding dawned on Nicholas. He recognized that divisions like these could potentially threaten the sovereignty of gridlords. He replied, "It's a bold idea, but I see the potential. If we could even win an extra orb or 2 for the city, it'd be worth it. You can trust me, my lord. Cincinnati is all I care about, and I'm honored to be considered for this responsibility." Brightforge's expression grew serious as he continued, "You'll need to make some cuts, Nicholas. Only the best should be trusted with such weapons. I'll see to it that you're given the best from other divisions to bolster your ranks. There will be no more greens among the 3rd. I'll also get you a new sergeant." Nicholas, panicking at the thought of losing Brian, quickly interjected, "But my lord, Brian is vital to our division. He may be green when it comes to battling with gridlords, but he is a veteran of many other fights against regular men. Our division loves him, and I trust him. You said yourself that you need people you can trust." Brightforge considered Nicholas's words, his demeanor making it clear that he would overrule him in a heartbeat if he felt it necessary. "Very well, let's see how it goes. You can hold on to Brian for now, but be prepared to cut him loose if needed. You have much to gain, Nicholas. Nobility, honors, even a fiefdom of your own. Loyalty to a friend is admirable, but you must also be sensible." Nicholas held his ground and replied with conviction, "My lord, I swear to you that Brian is the best man for the job, and he is loyal." Brightforge conceded, but Nicholas couldn't help but feel unsure of the depth of the gridlord's sincerity. Changing the tone, Brightforge said, "Enough of this solemn talk. We should be celebrating our victory." Brightforge stood up, his voice booming as he gathered the attention of everyone in the hall. Raising his glass high, he declared, "To Nicholas and the 3rd Division, their bravery and tactical brilliance brought us victory and another orb." The hall erupted in cheers and toasts, the air filled with jubilation and camaraderie as they celebrated their hard-won triumph. Chapter 8. Jax Wolf, the famed Pittsburgh Axe, sat atop a hill, his piercing gaze focused on the distant lights of Cincinnati. The flickering flames seemed to taunt him, for he knew that they were celebrating. A feast was to be held that night, a reward the Cincy Army would relish for capturing the wild orb. He couldn't help but feel a pang of frustration, cursing the fact that the orb had lain unclaimed for so long, within reach during the last campaign season. His fists clenched as he thought of the missed opportunity to duel his Cleveland rivals, to cross axes with Galehart and crush Brightforge. Thorne's heart raced as he imagined the thrill of battle, a sensation he had not experienced for months. The lust for glory and the desire to test his might consumed him, leaving him hungry and restless. Thorne's face contorted into a snarl as he begrudgingly acknowledged the fact that in there they were celebrating their victory while he himself burned with impatience, unfulfilled energy coursing through him. "If only I had known the orb had lain dormant so close," he muttered to himself, the fiery spark in his eyes reflecting his insatiable desire for action. "I could have flexed my might, brought my axe down on the enemy." The still night air did nothing to soothe Thorne's agitation. Instead, it only reminded him of his own solitude and isolation on the hilltop. As he watched the distant lights of Cincinnati grow dimmer, his longing for action intensified. With a determined huff, Thorne stood up and surveyed the horizon. "Rest assured, Cincinnati," he whispered, his voice laced with equal parts ambition and menace. "This may be your night to celebrate, but you've reignited a fire within me that won't be easily quenched. I'll be ready for the next battle, and you'll dearly regret your mistake of allowing the wild orb to escape my grasp, for I am Thorne Jaxwolf, and I will not be denied." Thorne's ears pricked at the distant hum of an approaching suit, the distinct sound of a gridlord using their footfield to speed across the landscape. A mixture of calm and eagerness washed over him. He hoped for an enemy to confront, his hand instinctively unhooking his glowing axe. But even as he prepared himself, he recognized the hum coming from the northeast, from home. As the pulse of energy revealed the monstrous form of Caius Hammerfist's power armor, Thorne couldn't help but feel disappointed to see a friend instead of a foe. He turned back, his hungry gaze settling once more on Cincinnati. "What the fuck are you doing?" Hammerfist asked gruffly. "Glowering like a sick puppy serves no purpose. Why waste your time and put yourself at risk? If the Scepter in the tower sees you, we'd lose our greatest asset. Think of our city and our friends." Thorne's frustrations poured out in a lengthy explanation. "I watched 3 gridlords and an army march into that city. The gridlords were glowing with the absorbed flows from the wild orb. I could have smashed them and taken those flows for myself." Hammerfist scoffed, his voice dripping with scorn. "So what? You think you could take on 3 suits and 3,000 men and still have time to absorb their flows? You're special, Thorne, but not even you could do that. Pittsburgh would be so much less without you." Thorne clenched his fists, the hunger in his eyes not subsiding. "I could have done it. With the element of surprise, I'd take down Brightforge first, then Hunter. Arkstone would be a problem, sure, but I could do it. And 3,000 men? That's easy." For a moment, Hammerfist seemed to contemplate the idea, but then he shook his head dismissively. "Don't be fucking stupid. Even if you could take them all on, the Scepter would just beam you down. It's not worth it." Thorne knew Hammerfist was right, but that didn't soothe his aching hunger for battle. The desire for glory and the opportunity to once again flex his might would not fade away so easily. Thorne growled under his breath, the sound rumbling through the air like a clap of thunder. He began to express the torment he felt in his soul when he had to deny his battle hunger for so long between campaign seasons. "It's like a fire within me," he said, his voice heavy with frustration. "It burns, demanding to be fed. When the campaign season ends, I'm left with this insatiable hunger. It gnaws at me day and night, and I feel like I'm going mad." He turned to face Hammerfist, his eyes full of raw emotion. There's just something about the heat of battle, the adrenaline that courses through my body when I swing my axe. It's like a drug, a siren's call I can't turn away from, and being without it feels like I'm being slowly suffocated. Thorn looked out towards the flickering lights of Cincinnati, their feasting almost mocking him from the distance. So they celebrate their little victories, ignorant of the storm that brews within me. If only they knew the true fury that lies dormant, waiting for the next opportunity to be unleashed. He clenched his fists, glaring at the distant city. This waiting, this constant hunger for battle, it's unbearable. And yet, I know I must endure it for the sake of our city and our friends. It just never gets any easier, Hammerfist. Never. As he spoke, Hammerfist could see the pain etched across Thorn's face, the torment of a warrior denied the very thing that fed his soul. It was clear that between campaigns, the greatest challenge Thorn faced was not the enemy, but his own insatiable hunger for battle that threatened to consume him. Hammerfist listened intently, his helmeted head tilting as he recognized the familiar struggles that Thorn described. After a moment, he responded with a depth of wisdom and understanding that only years of experience could bring. In my younger days, Thorn, I was much the same. That all-consuming desire for battle. It was an itch that I couldn't help but scratch. I was relentless, seeking every opportunity to prove myself in combat and to bask in the glory of each conquest. He paused, taking a deep breath, as memories of battles past flickered behind his eyes. But as the years went by, I began to understand the weight of responsibility that comes with being a gridlord. Our strength and our abilities are not just for our own satisfaction and gratification, but for the protection and well-being of our city and our people. Hammerfist glanced at Thorn, his voice filled with sincerity. You have such incredible potential, my friend. Time and time again, you've proven yourself as a formidable warrior on the battlefield. But you must learn to temper that hunger within you, to find the balance between your own desires and the needs of those who depend on you. He placed a heavy hand on Thorn's shoulder, the gesture one of genuine camaraderie and concern. I've had many years to come to terms with who I am as both a warrior and a man. It's been a journey of self-discovery and growth, one that I have no doubt you will also embrace. Thorn winced at Hammerfist's impassioned words. He wasn't accustomed to displaying such vulnerability and exposing his emotions. It felt like a weakness to him. Despite his discomfort, Thorn responded at length, the words tumbling out with an intensity that matched the fire within him. I am the greatest axe this world has ever seen, but I cannot help but feel that I am wallowing in complacency while our beloved Pittsburgh struggles. Our people deserve nothing less than the best, but we can't succeed like the Pittsburgh of old. We should hold the grid crown. Thorn knew Hammerfist was right, but that didn't soothe his aching hunger for battle. The desire for glory and the opportunity to once again flex his might would not fade away so easily. Thorn growled under his breath, the sound rumbling through the air like a clap of thunder. He began to express the torment he felt to soul when he had to deny his battle hunger for so long between campaign seasons. It's like a fire within me, he said, his voice heavy with frustration. It burns, demanding to be fed. When the campaign season ends, I'm left with this insatiable hunger. It gnaws at me, day and night, and I feel like I'm going mad. He turned to face Hammerfist, his eyes full of raw emotion. There's just something about the heat of battle, the adrenaline that courses through my body when I swing my axe. It's like a drug, a siren's call I can't turn away from, and being without it feels like I'm being slowly suffocated. Thorn looked out towards the flickering lights of Cincinnati, their feasting almost mocking him from the distance. So they celebrate their little victories, ignorant of the storm that brews within me. If only they knew the true fury that lies dormant, waiting for the next opportunity to be unleashed. He clenched his fists, glaring at the distant city. This waiting, this constant hunger for battle, it's unbearable. And yet, I know I must endure it for the sake of our city and our friends. It just never gets any easier, Hammerfist. Never. As he spoke, Hammerfist could see the pain etched across Thorn's face, the torment of a warrior denied the very thing that fed his soul. It was clear that between campaigns, the greatest challenge Thorn faced was not the enemy, but his own insatiable hunger for battle that threatened to consume him. Hammerfist listened intently, his helmeted head tilting as he recognized the familiar struggles that Thorn described. After a moment, he responded with a depth of wisdom and understanding that only years of experience could bring. "In my younger days, Thorn, I was much the same. That all-consuming desire for battle, it was an itch that I couldn't help but scratch. I was relentless, seeking every opportunity to prove myself in combat and to bask in the glory of each conquest." He paused, taking a deep breath as memories of battles past flickered behind his eyes. "But as the years went by, I began to understand the weight of responsibility that comes with being a Gridlord. Our strength and our abilities are not just for our own satisfaction and gratification, but for the protection and well-being of our city and our people." Hammerfist glanced at Thorn, his voice filled with sincerity. "You have such incredible potential, my friend. Time and time again, you've proven yourself as a formidable warrior on the battlefield. But you must learn to temper that hunger within you, to find the balance between your own desires and the needs of those who depend on you." He placed a heavy hand on Thorn's shoulder, the gesture one of genuine camaraderie and concern. "I've had many years to come to terms with who I am as both a warrior and a man. It's been a journey of self-discovery and growth, one that I have no doubt you will also embrace." Thorn winced at Hammerfist's impassioned words. He wasn't accustomed to displaying such vulnerability and exposing his emotions. It felt like a weakness to him. Despite his discomfort, Thorn responded at length, the words tumbling out with an intensity that matched the fire within him. "I am the greatest axe this world has ever seen, but I cannot help but feel that I am wallowing in complacency while our beloved Pittsburgh struggles. Our people deserve nothing less than the best, but we can't succeed like the Pittsburgh of old. We should hold the grid crown." Hammerfist placed a reassuring hand on Thorn's shoulder, his tone earnest and persuasive. "Roland, even old and mad, didn't have us by his side in Denver. Whatever strength he has left, combined with our own might, will be more than enough to crush anyone who stands in our way. There are many cities that would give anything to have even one Gridlord with the power you, I, or Pikestorm possess." His grip on Thorn's shoulder tightened, his voice filled with conviction. "With Roland at his worst, no one can stop us, and on his best day, we could conquer the world." Thorn couldn't help but feel eager and somewhat mollified by Hammerfist's words. The heaviness in his chest began to dissipate as he pictured the great feats yet to come. Now, Hammerfist's tone turned more jovial, his armored hand giving Thorn's shoulder a friendly pat. "For the love of fuck, let's go home. There's drink, food, and women waiting for us. We can enjoy ourselves and pass the time until the new campaign season begins." Thorn finally relented, accepting Hammerfist's proposal to return home. The two Gridlords, standing side by side, summoned their footfields, powerful currents of energy that would allow them to race across the landscape at startling speeds. With a shared, determined nod, they burst into motion, their armored forms streaking through the night like celestial warriors come to life. The small hamlets and houses they passed were completely unaware of the proximity of these godlike beings, soaring just beyond their reach, leaving only a fleeting whisper in their wake. Clive slept deeply, seemingly undisturbed. The room he woke up in resembled a well-appointed hotel, or perhaps a cabin aboard the Starship Enterprise, a stark contrast to the dirty, medieval streets he saw outside the previous day, teeming with animals and the hustle and bustle of people. Lying in bed and staring at his surroundings, Clive noticed a console on one side of the room and felt the hum of the air conditioner above. He was intrigued by the technology, wondering how it could exist within this medieval setting. As he pondered these mysteries, the door to his room opened, and a young serving girl entered with a tray of food. "I'm Erilyn," she said hesitantly, looking around the room. "I hope I'm not disturbing you. You're an honored guest of Elder Jarway, and he hopes to see you soon. The cook told me to bring you some food so you'll have time to eat." Clive, feeling slightly less disoriented than the day before, thanked her. Eager to learn more about the world he found himself in, he said, "Thank you, Erilyn. Can I ask, where are you from?" Erilyn, smiling shyly, replied, "Here, of course. Well, not from here. I mean, not from the tower. I'm from the outer sector of the city. I was very happy to get this job. Working in the tower is great. Today is my first day, and I'm still learning my way around the place. As Clive sat down to eat the meal Erilyn had brought, he decided his first task should be to gather as much information as possible about this strange world. Clive stared down at his plate, expecting some form of medieval fare. Instead, before him lay a platter filled with a classic American breakfast. Crispy bacon, fluffy scrambled eggs, golden brown hash browns, buttered toast, and a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice on the side. He couldn't believe the sight and smell of the familiar food, presented so deliciously. Looking to Erilyn, Clive asked, "Is this a normal meal here?" Erilyn replied, "For those who can afford it, yes. In the place where I'm from, though, it's a rare treat. It's easier to cook this sort of food in the higher sectors since their technology is better." Taking a bite from the delectable spread, Clive probed further. "What are these sectors you mentioned, and how is their technology different?" Confused by Clive's seeming ignorance but eager to please, Erilyn explained, "The sectors revolve around the tower. Different sectors have different levels of technological advancements. The tower at the center always has the best and most advanced technology. Thanks to the flows, as you make your way outwards, technology becomes more scarce, save predominantly for the rich, nobles, merchants, and priests." "So technology just doesn't work in the lower sectors?" Clive inquired. Nodding her agreement, Erilyn elaborated, "We have some things that work, like battery-powered lamps and toys. Our houses aren't wired for electricity, so we rely on batteries for power. Sometimes the tower deems a sector deserving enough to have a higher order, allowing those technologies to work. But that's a rare and special treat." Clive, while deep in thought about the inequalities surrounding him, noticed Erilyn looking longingly at his meal. With a kind smile, he said, "Hey, why don't you have some of this? There's more than enough for me. Please, join me." Erilyn hesitated, her politeness holding her back. "Oh, I couldn't, sir. It's not my place." Clive insisted, "Nonsense. There's too much food here for me alone. Besides," he patted his pot belly, "I can't afford the extra calories." Seeing his sincerity, Erilyn finally relented and moved closer. She perched on the edge of the bed and tentatively sampled the food. As she tasted it, her expression shifted to one of pure ecstasy. As they shared the meal, Clive's curiosity grew. "Can you explain more about these flows you mentioned earlier? What are they exactly?" Erilyn, savoring each bite, responded, "Flows are gathered from orbs, which are usually found in the wilds. The flows create the order fields, enabling technology to function." Clive raised an eyebrow. "That's fascinating. So, if the order in a particular area is low, then even a simple battery-powered lamp wouldn't work?" While chewing, Erilyn nodded enthusiastically and said, "Exactly. It would be completely useless, like it's dead. But if the order is raised, we can do things like play games, read, and even indulge in shadow puppetry. All of this is so much nicer with proper light than relying on oil lamps or firelight." Clive's mind raced, connecting flows and orders with the research he had been conducting before he found himself in this strange new world. Just as Clive was about to ask what an orb actually was, there was a knock on the door. Erilyn quickly bolted up from her seat, not wanting to be seen in an inappropriate situation. The door opened, and a guard entered, a far cry from the medieval soldiers Clive had seen on the streets. This man wore modern armor, carried an automatic rifle, and had an intriguingly futuristic sword strapped to his belt. Erilyn nervously addressed the guard. "Sir Hearthguard, I hope I find you well. I'll be on my way now. There's much to do." Hearthguard dismissed her with a wave and turned his gaze towards Clive. It seemed as though he was entertaining the thought that something more intimate had been going on between them. But his tone was sly and somewhat playful, not unkind. "Elder Jarway is waiting," Hearthguard said. "It's time for you to come along. I'll escort you to the gardens." As Clive put on his shoes, he had slept in his clothes, he asked, "Is Elder Jarway the leader of Denver?" Hearthguard replied, "He is one of the most senior elders. Denver is governed by a council. Where do you hail from, stranger? Out in the wilds, perhaps?" Clive, somewhat evasive, responded, "Something like that." Together, they ventured through a sci-fi maze of hallways and eventually arrived at an elevator, which would take them to their destination. Throughout the elevator ride, Clive and Hearthguard shared no conversation. Clive observed the elevator's mechanisms, noting how touchscreens were used to operate it. All around him, everything looked remarkably sleek and modern, more advanced than anything in his own world, a mix of metal, glass, and plastics. The elevator descended and came to a stop in a vast foyer chamber that Clive barely remembered from the night before. Everything had been such a blur, leaving him in a daze. As they walked, Knight gestured towards a doorway. "The gardens are through here," he said. "Elder Jarway enjoys the gardens. It's a quieter place to talk, more private, with fewer ears. He seems to think you're important. You're probably not from the wilds, then?" Clive responded noncommittally. "Let's just say it's complicated." Feeling equally intrigued and guarded, Clive followed Hearthguard through the doorway and into the gardens, curious to see what Elder Jarway had in store. As Clive stepped through the doorway, he was greeted by the sight of lush gardens that seemed to stretch out in every direction. It was evident that a great deal of thought and care had been put into the landscape's design. The air smelled clean, refreshing, and invigorating, a stark contrast to the scents he had encountered in the medieval city. Manicured lawn areas were punctuated with elegant flower beds, filled with vibrant colors from a variety of blossoming plants. The meticulously trimmed hedges and topiaries were woven throughout the gardens, creating a tapestry of greenery that appeared to dance under the sunlight. As Clive ventured further, he noticed that the gardens were not solely limited to flora. Carefully constructed water features added a soothing soundtrack to the peaceful environment. Streams of crystal-clear water meandered between flower beds, and small bridges were constructed from wood and stone, providing a pathway for visitors to meander through the gardens without disturbing the verdant carpet. In quiet, shaded alcoves, Clive glimpsed benches nestled among the foliage, where it seemed that one could indulge in private thoughts or intimate conversations. Dotting the landscape were statues of intricate craftsmanship, displaying the prowess of the artists in this realm. The gardens housed a variety of plant life that Clive did not recognize, hailing from both the world he knew and from the one he found himself in now. Trees reached for the sky, their branches outstretched like arms offering solace and comfort to those who sought a brief respite from the world outside. Each area seemed to be deliberately organized to evoke particular emotions. Some spaces instilled a sense of peace and tranquility, with soft, flowing grasses swaying gently in the breeze. Others evoked a sense of energy and vibrancy, featuring vivid bursts of color from blossoming flowers and elaborately shaped topiaries. The harmony of man-made order and natural beauty created a sanctuary that felt removed from the world beyond the garden walls. As Clive continued to follow Hearthguard in search of Elder Jarway, he couldn't help but feel grateful for this moment of serenity in a world that had so far been marked by confusion and chaos. They soon found Elder Jarway sitting by a pond, where he seemed to be engrossed in watching the fish swimming lazily below the surface. Even in this idyllic setting, Clive couldn't help but notice that the fish bore a slight oddness. They appeared similar to carp, but with bizarre features that reminded him just how far from his own world he was. Jarway stood up as they approached and began speaking with Hearthstone. "Thank you for bringing our guest, Hearthguard. Have you heard whether your brother has returned?" "With all respect, my lord, I believe you'd be the first to know if my brother had arrived," Hearthguard replied. Jarway chuckled at Hearthguard's response. "You're right, I would be." "How is your wife doing, Hearthguard?" Jarway inquired with genuine warmth. "She's doing well, thank you for asking, my lord," Hearthguard answered proudly. "She's been busy taking care of our newborn daughter." Jarway smiled. "Congratulations on your newest addition. I look forward to meeting her someday soon. Your children bring life and joy to our community." With a nod of gratitude, Hearthguard replied, "Thank you, Elder. I'll make sure to let my wife know you were asking." After they exchanged a few more pleasantries, Hearthguard took his leave, and Clive found himself alone with Elder Jarway in the peaceful garden. Jarway, appearing less stern than during their previous encounter, inquired about Clive's well-being. "How did you sleep? Did you find the room comfortable? How was your breakfast?" Clive, aware of Jarway's leadership position and power, answered docilely, "I slept well, thank you. The room was very comfortable, and the breakfast was delicious. There was a brief silence between them. Clive felt as though Jarway was deliberately using the quiet to provoke him into speaking. He tried to resist the discomfort, but it soon got the better of him. Eventually, Clive asked, "What do you intend to do with me? What use do you expect to make of my situation?" Jarway regarded him thoughtfully before responding. "If what you claimed yesterday is true, that you're from the before, then you have the potential to be of great importance here. Your arrival is an amazing phenomenon, a miracle, even. The extent of your knowledge could prove invaluable, and your unique traits could make you a valuable asset to our community." Clive explained his confusion. "I don't know what the before or even the now really means. One moment, I was working in my lab on a project, and the next, I found myself standing in that strange stone room." Jarway leaned in, his curiosity piqued. "Tell me about the nature of your project." Clive hesitated for a moment before explaining. "I was working on what we called function fields. It was a new technology that seemed to control entropy, affecting the fineness of tech that could operate." Jarway nodded thoughtfully. "Ah, we call them order fields here. So this technology was relatively new in your time?" "Yes," Clive replied. "It was cutting-edge technology, and the potential applications were vast, ranging from military to civilian purposes." Clive continued, his voice becoming more animated as he expounded on the implications of the technology. "In the military, imagine entire battlefields where advanced technology abruptly ceases to function. Rifles would be reduced to clubs, and tanks would become useless hunks of metal. The side that could control the effect of these fields would have a major advantage." He paused, his eyes wide with enthusiasm. "Now picture the civilian applications. Urban centers could be designed to enhance the functioning of technology within their limits, leading to more efficient energy production, communication, and travel. On the other hand, wilderness areas could be designated as low-tech zones, preserving their natural state." Clive glanced at Jarway, whose eyebrow was raised in interest. "The possibilities are nearly endless. Had we been able to refine and master this technology, it could have revolutionized our society in countless ways, opening up new avenues of development that we could have never before imagined." Jarway stared back at Clive, his eyes filled with a knowing wisdom. Clive faltered as he realized that the technology he spoke so passionately about had in fact been mastered, and his own world was left far behind. Becoming emotional, Clive stuttered, "When am I?" Jarway countered with his own question. "When were you?" Clive responded, his voice barely above a whisper, 2024. Still unsure of the specifics, Jarway asked, "Does this mean you were before or after the 2100s? "Before, way before," Clive said, feeling increasingly uneasy. Jarway explained, "The before ended sometime around the 2100s. The exact date is unsure, but 2169 seems the likeliest." Clive felt as if his head was about to explode. "When is now?" Jarway's brow furrowed. "It's hard to tell. After the before, there were years, decades, even centuries of chaos. Humanity was reduced to little more than animals struggling to survive. We were more prey than predator." As Jarway spoke, Clive tried to process the enormity of the situation he found himself in, an epoch far removed from everything he had ever known. Jarway continued, enthusiastically expanding on the history of their time. "This is the year 1025. We began our dating system with the day the Oracle gave the first worthy people, a tower, in Chicago, to Padraig Dragonheart. That marked the beginning of the modern era, when towers emerged from the ground, and the Oracle began to show us the way to defeat entropy." Clive's mind raced, overwhelmed with thoughts and questions. He picked one out of the fray and asked, "Towers rose from the ground?" "Yes," Jarway affirmed. "The Oracle found Padraig to be pure of heart and gifted him with a tower that grew from the soil itself. It was the first of many. The next was in Green Bay, bestowed upon Padraig's sister, Lady Bridget, the first sword." Listening to Jarway's tale, Clive tried to absorb and reconcile the incredible history of this new world he found himself in. "So, this tower event happened over 1,000 years ago?" Clive questioned. "Yes," Jarway confirmed. "Our dating system has been accurate since the appearance of the towers." Clive pondered, "And the time before that is unknown, all the way back to 2169? Jarway nodded, Yes, it's believed to have been centuries, but our sources from that era are scattered and often contradictory. Trying to wrap his head around it all, Clive concluded, "So if I really have traveled through time, it's been at least 1169 years." Jarway corrected him. "Not time traveled exactly. The priests believe you were brought here by the prophet." Intrigued, Clive asked, "What is the prophet?" Jarway recounted, "It was a glowing aura and was discovered just before the oracle granted the Denver Tower." Curiosity piqued, fearing he knew suddenly, Clive inquired, "Was it something like a tear in reality? A blinding, diffuse light suspended in the air?" Jarway, a touch of sadness in his voice as he thought of the prophet's disappearance, replied, "Yes, it was something like that." Jarway continued to describe the prophet, his voice soft and nostalgic. "The prophet was an enigmatic presence, with no clear form or defined edges. It was an ever-shifting array of colors and shapes, like a living aurora dancing in the air. The phenomenon radiated a quiet power, an almost otherworldly energy that seemed to both inspire and humble those who stood in its presence." He paused, recalling his experiences with the ethereal entity. "Being near the prophet, one couldn't help but feel drawn to it and overwhelmed with a sense of awe, yet also compelled to look away so as not to be entirely overtaken by its beauty and majesty. Truly, it was unlike anything we'd ever seen before." As Jarway spoke, Clive's heart grew cold. Deep down, he realized that the prophet may very well be the function field he had been working on when Brett warned him about safety concerns, a time he now knew was over 1,000 years ago.
New episodes every Friday, with newer episodes always waiting for Grid Lords on Patreon.